Wonderful. Well, I hope that first session was helpful, and I hope it was easier to maintain concentration, given that rather than addressing the questions head-on with practical stuff, we kind of opened up the scriptures together. And we're going to do the same thing in this session. We've got about 40 minutes, and after those 40 minutes, we'll do lunch, and then after lunch, Callum, who's disappeared, is going to give two sessions, one on science and one on the reliability of the Bible, particularly the New Testament. And then we'll open up for Q&A at the very end of the day. But this is such a long day, actually, when you think about it. And I'm just both surprised and delighted at how many people have turned out. So let's do it together. We'll finish strong, and then we'll go through to the end. But I hope that in that session you found answers to these kinds of questions. One, what might it look like to start conversations? We're going to address that more particularly in this session as well. How to go deeper in conversations, how apologetics serves evangelism, and things that hold us back from doing evangelism. But there's more that can be said about these things, and hence this session now. I haven't had the chance to speak with a number of you yet, so lunch will be really good for that, but I know there's a number of stories represented. One of those stories could be that you're an incredible evangelist, and but you're also humble, and so you jump at the idea of being more equipped. Genuinely, that wasn't a joke, I'm not sure why we're laughing. Usually Australians laugh at random stuff, but hey, you're in good company, I'll say that much. Another story represented could be you've always just gotten really scared at the idea of talking with non-Christians. It's not that you don't want to, it's just that it seems like a foreign concept to you. That's a perfectly legitimate place to be, and actually being here with that sense of heart is going to be really helpful. There could also just be people who are like in this room who are like armchair philosophers, and they like knowing the stuff, but actually putting themselves at the intersection between what N.T. Wright calls the love of God and the pain of the world. That's not so easy. I'd rather sit back in my armchair. So all this is going to be helpful, but also challenging for all of us with all our different stories represented. But I would guess the most common story is this, that we just want to engage. We just want to talk with non-Christians. We just want to see them come to know Jesus, the church grow bigger, those in it be edified and encouraged. But we live in such a fascinating cultural moment. I'm not sure if you're aware of this. One of the guys in our ministry has called this moment the technological age of questions. So we've got like a rise in immigration, globalization, technology, and the internet gives us untold depths of knowledge about other people in their particular cultural place with their own worldview. And it means that we have all these worldviews coming to the church's door, all kinds of questions coming, which before would have just not been known. Questions like, why is Jesus the only way? Because I grew up in a culture where the Eightfold Path of Buddhism was the way. That just wouldn't have been a question people asked in years gone by, but with the rise in globalization, we now have those questions at the door of the church. Which means if we want to be able to fulfill the Great Commission and present people with the reason for the hope that we have, then we need to be able to engage this cultural moment. And the fascinating thing about this, I'm not sure if you've seen this yet, but just a few weeks ago, a survey was done by the Barna Group in the States. Not saying that England is represented by the States, by no means, but they are, in some sense, representative of the West in general. And a study was done by the Barna Group on millennials and iGen. So millennials being those that are about in their 20s to 30s, and iGen being those that are sort of from 1 through to 19 at this point, years of age. Less so with other generations, but this is really fascinating to think about whether you were in that category or not, because the study found that almost all practicing Christians believe that part of their faith means being a witness about Jesus, and that the best thing for anyone on this earth to ever happen to them, 94% of Christians, all practicing Christians said this, the best thing for anything to ever happen to anyone on earth is for them to be a Christian. And millennials in particular feel really equipped to share their faith. We live in the age of information. If you want to learn how to share your faith, just download a crash course online, right? Everyone feels really equipped. But here's the fascinating thing. Millennials, 20s to 30s year old, despite feeling incredibly equipped, the survey found that just under half, 47% agree that it's wrong to share one's personal beliefs with someone of a different faith in the hope that they will share the same faith. 47% of millennials in the States believe that it's wrong to share their faith with a view to converting someone. And for Gen X and baby boomers, it's more like 27% and 20%, which is still quite shocking if you're a practicing Christian who feels equipped to share their faith. And one of the reasons posited, this isn't confirmed, but one of the reasons posited to explain that gap between feeling equipped but feeling wrong to share their faith is the idea that in the mind of this generation, evangelism brings with it the imagery of like tent tours, the Billy Graham era, where we've got the truth and we're going to present it. Now, one, that's an incredibly odd caricature of Billy Graham and his ministry, unfortunately, who did wonderful things. But it's a view of sharing one's faith as fundamentally divisive, and it casts judgment. And that's the reason posited as to why they don't want to share their faith. And one of the common beliefs amongst millennials, actually, is something that's commonly been misattributed to a guy named St. Francis of Assisi, which is oddly relevant at this point. And you'd know the phrase, I imagine, preach the gospel at all times, if necessary, use words. Now, he never said this. No one can find the source where St. Francis of Assisi said these words. In fact, he was famous for preaching. He used to preach to pigeons when he was in a carriage just so he could practice how he presented the gospel. He loved preaching. Now, I want to say this. There's something fundamentally positive about this desire not to sort of drop truth bombs on the heads of those that disagree with us. Something fundamentally positive about this, and it's this, that the Bible takes character really seriously. And sometimes when we present truth, we can do a very big disservice to it by not representing it well in the way that we communicate. And if you jump back to 1 Peter 3, you'll notice actually that the whole book that leads up to that injunction and from that injunction is all about pursuing holiness. Chapter 1 is about pursuing holiness. Chapter 2 is about injunctions for slaves and wives and husbands and people to live a moral life. And chapter 3, just before that, is about not fearing what those that hurt that your enemies will do to you, living otherwise for the glory of God. And then the injunction comes, and one of the assumptions that the New Testament writers work with and that we should work with is actually people are going to ask you questions when they see your faith working. So there's something fundamentally positive about this idea that I don't want to cast judgment on people. That's the wrong result. The result should be that we care about our character, not about not sharing. That's really important. And just, I want to share this one story from a letter that survives from the second century before we jump into Acts 17 right here. It's called the Letter to Diognetus. And one thing that the early Christians were famous for was not having the right answers to the right questions. It was for living the right lives in persecution that caused people to ask questions. And a letter, it's not known to whom it was written, but it's known who wrote it, a guy named Diognetus. And it just talks about the lives of Christians in the Roman Empire. It says this, just get a whiff of this, it's amazing. They dwell in their own countries, but simply as sojourners. As citizens, they share in all things with others and yet endure all things as foreigners. Every foreign land to them is as their native country, and every land of their birth as a land of strangers. They marry, as do all others. They beget children, but they do not destroy their offspring. They have a common table, but not a common bed. They are in the flesh, but they do not live according to the flesh. They pass their days on earth, but they are citizens of heaven. They obey the prescribed laws, and at the same time surpass the laws by their lives. And if you jump down to the end, there's this wonderful phrase that says, to sum it all up in one word, what the soul is to the body, Christians are to the world. And there's something fundamentally good about this desire not to be the loudmouth Christians that know the truth and cast judgment on people that disagree with us. Fundamentally good. But if that ever leads us not to share Jesus with people, articulating the hope that we have, then we've shifted the target. Because the Great Commission still applies. And so here would be my takeaway point from this little juncture. And then we'll get into Acts 17. The New Testament writers assume that people will ask you questions when they see your faith working. And the goal I think that gives us is this. Live such a life that people ask you questions to which only the gospel is the answer. Live such a life that people ask you questions to which only the gospel is the answer. Because we preach a life-changing message. We need to live life-changed days. And so we go to the Apostle Paul, and we're going to look at a text which has for centuries just informed the church about what it looks like to do evangelism. And we might not get through it all. I've got a lot here, but I'll give you the 4 points that we're going to tackle. And if you have any other questions that we don't get to at the very end, we'll address it in the Q&A or just in conversation over lunch. But this text has been so informative for the church over the years. And some people, interestingly enough, question the legitimacy of viewing this text as a model for our evangelism. Other scholars would say, actually, this is the model. And I think both of them are wrong. It's got stuff to say, is, I guess, the point that I would make. And the reason that's the case is because this isn't the only time that the writer, Luke, captures speech that Paul makes to people in the book of Acts. There's actually 3 speeches. The first speech is to Jews and God-fearers in chapter 13. The second is to illiterate pagans in chapter 14. And the third speech is to philosophers and the Areopagus in chapter 17, which is the one that we're going to look at. And I think we can learn 2 things, even before we get into the text, about Paul in his evangelism. And that's this one thing first, that he's so versatile. He speaks the language of the people to whom he's speaking. He is happy to put himself at that intersection and speak their language. And I think that just gives complete, I guess, evidence to the phrase that he'd utter in 1 Corinthians 9. It's this, though I'm free and belong to no one, I've made myself a slave to everyone, to win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. He's literally describing his missionary journeys at this point. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, so as to win those under the law. And then he goes on to the very end. He says, to the weak, I became weak to win the weak. I have become all things to all people, so that by all possible means, I might save some. And I think before we even get into Acts 17, you realize there's a whole host of other stories and encounters Paul has in the book of Acts. And wow, he's versatile. Be versatile. And the second thing we learn is actually, though it's not the only text that Luke gives us, it's actually probably the most relevant for our cultural moment, and that's why we would look at it. So we're not looking at it because it's the only text, it's one of 3 in the book of Acts, but it is incredibly relevant. So before we get into it, just let me say Luke's gospel, let me set the scene. Luke's gospel finishes with Jesus giving the commission to his disciples, saying, you will be my witnesses. Then Acts 1 picks up that very same language and says in verse 8, you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth. So the Holy Spirit comes, the church grows, Peter preaches, Paul preaches, someone falls asleep at some point, Stephen gets stoned, and the church makes its way out from Jerusalem, Judea, and then to all of Samaria. And then this church hub gets planted in Antioch, and that becomes the base of Paul's missionary journeys, and then the 3 missionary journeys, first, second, and third. And it's in one of those that we get to Paul in the Areopagus. And we won't read the text. We'll just go through it verse by verse. And as we do that, I got something else I wanted to pull out here. And it's this. One more thing, and then I'll give you the structure for the next 30 minutes. Paul, interestingly, arrived in Athens, and the speech that we get in Acts 17 shouldn't even exist. And there's a reason for that. And I think the fact that we do have it should teach us something about evangelism, and it should combat the things that we get scared about in doing evangelism. And so that's why I wanted to draw this out. He arrives in Athens alone, by boat from Berea. His companions, Timothy and Silas, from the beginning of chapter 17, were back in Berea. And if you're familiar with the text, you'll know 3 things. That one, he actually felt called to Macedonia, which is the place from which he'd come. He never wanted to go to Athens. He felt called to Macedonia. One chapter earlier it reads, after Paul had seen the vision, we got ready at once, that's Luke speaking, to leave for Macedonia, concluding that God had called us to preach the gospel to them. So Paul's call is elsewhere, not to Athens. That's interesting. The second thing you know is that last time he was near the marketplace was in Philippi, again in chapter 16, and when he preached there, he actually converted some people, and that made the friends of those people who were converted really angry. And Paul had to leave really, really quickly. And his life was actually in danger. That's why he had to leave. That's interesting. The last time Paul was in a marketplace, he nearly died. And the third thing is, the text literally says while Paul was waiting. That's the third thing I want to take note of. And so here's the point. Paul wasn't called to Athens. He was called to Macedonia. The risk of preaching and witnessing about Jesus in the marketplace, according to his experience, was, wow, this could get me stoned. And more than that, he was just waiting. And here's the point I want to draw out. So often, a lot of us don't share our faith because we think, one, I'm not called. Or two, the risk is too great. Or three, that there just isn't enough time. And I think our greatest temptation actually today is the latter. And it's interesting because if Paul wasn't called to Athens, but we have one of the greatest examples of evangelism ever recorded for us, I think it's a great encouragement for us who sometimes disqualify ourselves because we don't have the sense within us that says we're called. And so for those of you in the room that think, maybe I'm not called to evangelism, I just want to break that and say the Great Commission still applies to you. And I hope that's more liberating than it is paralyzing. And the second thing is, I think the greatest risk for us in our context is not the risk of life, it's the risk of not being liked. I feel this so much as an Australian, we just want to be liked by people. And the more I consider that, that's just not a good enough reason. I want to say something profound there, but I think that's all that needs to be said. It'd be a shame to finish this life and be withheld from sharing the gospel with people because we're afraid of not being liked. The good news is the church is full of people you don't like anyway, so that's what it means to be part of the family of God. And then the last thing is, this is the biggest thing I think for us in our fast-paced lives, we think we just don't have enough time. And to that I want to say two things. I was standing in line waiting for a coffee one day at a church, and I just struck up a conversation with a lady, and she was there with her husband, and they'd actually come up to Brisbane from Perth. And they were doing a big road trip, and I was just asking about her life, and she had tears in her eyes. God was clearly doing something, and she said something like, yeah, I've been out of church for years, but I sort of came to this service today while I was on my road trip, and God really spoke to me. I was like, wow, tell me about that. Turns out she's an MP down in Perth or Adelaide or something, and so just a woman of influence and someone in whom God's doing something wonderful, and so that was just really exciting. But then her husband was there. And I struck up a conversation with him. And I was waiting for my coffee at this point. I had another task. And I just started talking to him. And I said, are you a man of faith? What's your background? Love to hear your story. And he kind of just went silent and got all Australian about it and was like, yeah, that stuff's, yeah. And that's all he said. And so I just said, I mean, it's pretty confrontational, but I just said, oh, can I pray for you? And I mean, my coffee was there waiting to be drunk and didn't have enough time. I was going to go cold, but I was like, no, I'm going to pray for this guy. So I prayed for him. And as I finished praying, he had tears in his eyes, and he just said, thank you so much. I don't know what happened to him in his story, but I know that his wife's heart's affections had been stirred for God, and I know that they went back to their home, and I know that God really used that time that I thought I didn't have. So we always don't think we have time. The second thing I want to say about that objection and that fear of getting into evangelism is this. Schedule time. I realize I won't pray if I don't schedule it these days. Some of you might have found that to be true. Schedule time in your calendar for evangelism. It sounds really odd, but it's actually so fruitful and helpful because you say, wow, this next half an hour, I'm just going to go strike up a conversation with a goal of asking second and third questions, connecting questions of them. And when it gets to a deep point, I'm going to be praying about the question I can ask them, whether it's going to be something from God, and hopefully God's going to unlock some stuff. So all that aside, We shouldn't feel disqualified from evangelism because of calling, lack of time, or other purposes. The Great Commission still applies. So we want to talk this morning about four things, and I think we'll get through the first one. That's going to be good. I'm kidding. So we're going to talk about where Paul went, what Paul saw, what Paul said, and what Paul felt. And if you're wondering where I came up with those awesome titles, it's actually from a commentary by John Stott. It's a wonderful commentary in the book of Acts. It's called The Bible Speaks Today. Other good commentaries on this chapter are Craig Keener, N.T. Wright, and a gentleman who did his PhD on this, a gentleman named Lars Dahl. But you can get those resources from me later if you want to. Where Paul went, what Paul saw, what Paul said, and what Paul felt. And so you jump down and we hit verse 17. It says, Paul reasoned in the synagogue with both Jews and God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace by day with those who happened to be there. And so Paul goes to two places, the synagogue and the marketplace. And the first one's quite simple. Why would Paul go to the synagogue? Well, for the same reason that we'd go next door, or the same reason we'd knock on our neighbor's house. It's that those that are closest to us geographically are going to be those that speak our language. Or maybe more particularly for this setting, those that are similar to us in cultural background or religious background are actually going to be more similar to us, and it's going to be easier for us to speak the language. And so a lot of us have in our minds, I want to go reach this particular people group or person, or that's great, do it please. But also know that it's going to be a lot easier for you. There's going to be more traction gained if we just go to people that we're like. We can talk about things that we like. The risk if you do that, however, here's the risk. If you go to people that you're like, you end up just talking about stuff that you like. Which is why when I go and play football with non-Christians, the real risk for me is that I just end up talking about the football. There's a value in that, but there's also a value in telling them about Jesus. And so the encouragement, again, that I'd give would be ask those connecting questions, go deeper in conversation rather than just, did you see the Manchester United game? Did you see the Manchester City game? Did you see the Liverpool game? No, ask those connecting questions. The second place Paul goes, and this is the main point I want to draw out from this part where Paul went, he goes to the marketplace day by day. Now, what's that? And the bad news is that our translation just won't get across exactly what the marketplace was, nor will our cultural moment give us any example of it. It's called the agora in the Greek, the marketplace. It's the place where everyone goes. Now, at that point in time, Athens was the cultural and the intellectual capital of the Roman Empire. It wasn't the military capital. That had been the case in the 6th century BC, but at this point, it was the cultural capital. It's where Plato, Aristotle, and Socrates spoke and taught, and it sort of had like a gravitas to it. You thought, Athens, wow. And in the midst of Athens was the place where they taught, where all this stuff happened. So who was there? Everybody. Everybody's in the marketplace. Businessmen, artists, poets, scholars, lecturers, lawyers, philosophers, all of them were there. Because in that context, you didn't have media. So the herald would stand up in the marketplace and declare to people news from Rome, from afar, what's going on in their context. You didn't have academic journals, so philosophers would just debate one another. I mean, a lot of our philosophy is done now where we just sit behind a keyboard and bang out what we think is sounds nice, but just imagine the intellect you'd need to have to stand there in situ debating philosophies. The marketplace was where everything happened. Put it this way, the marketplace was the center of ancient public life. Which means that it wasn't just where you shopped for food, it was where you shopped for ideas. Now, just think about this for a second. Paul takes his faith there. He doesn't take his ideas there. He doesn't take his opinions there. He doesn't take another philosophy journal there. He takes his faith there. And this is where it gets really interesting, because for the modern secular person, those that have been brought up in the waters of our atheistic culture, separation of church and state, faith is something that needs to remain private. For the modern secular person, faith is what you do behind closed doors, but never let it impinge on my happiness. Interestingly, this is actually a really pagan idea. See, in paganism, it says that everybody has a god for a specific task. And that's fine, but don't tell me that there's a God who's God above my gods. That's what paganism says. Don't tell me that my God is not really God. Make sure you keep your God to yourself for the task that you have in this life. But the Bible doesn't let that be true. And this is just logic. So if God is really the God of all gods, then there's no sense in which it would make sense to keep our God to ourselves. If God's really Lord over everything, then he's relevant to the marketplace, which means faith is not inherently private, it's inherently public. Theologically speaking, now we can track out how that looks, but the injunction, if Jesus Christ is really Lord and all the other gods are not, and all the other lords are not, the injunction is that God is relevant to the public sphere. And this is actually what Peter spoke about in the upper room at Pentecost. He said this, "Therefore, let all Israel be assured of this. God has made this Jesus, whom you crucified, both Lord and Messiah." And so Paul takes that theology with great confidence into the public square. And he says, come and see him. Do you want to know the true God above all your other gods? Do you want to know the true Lord? See, the problem with the pagan view of faith is that it's private. And there's two problems with that philosophy when it comes to witnessing. If your fundamental understanding of witnessing is about a private faith, you'll either become someone who, when you witness, avoids the marketplace of ideas altogether, or when you go there, you'll be too accommodating to it. And that's really important when you're talking about and thinking about engaging with non-Christians. See, you avoid the marketplace of ideas because you can't imagine how this claim that Jesus Christ is Lord can have any impact or relevance or power in the setting of the public sphere. So you keep it private because you don't want to rock the boat. You don't speak out on public issues to which God and the theology of him makes a claim. Could you imagine if Paul did that? It would have been really easy for him to stay in Jerusalem, chill out, kick back in the synagogues where everyone's talking about religious ideas already, but he takes his faith to the public sphere. Now, on the other hand, just imagine if Paul was too accommodating when he went to the public sphere. Imagine if for him, Jesus Christ wasn't really Lord, but he was just one of a number of gods on offer. He might say, rather than Jesus being Lord of all, this just makes him one of a plethora of options. And this just reduces Jesus to pluralism and relativity. It means that the God we worship isn't really the God of all. He's just one of many, and take your pick, whatever satisfies you. Could you imagine if he did that? Imagine if he said, oh, Jesus? No, he's not that different. He's just the same as the other gods you worship. Pleasure, satisfaction, money, wealth, success. He's just the same. If he helps you get those things, great. But could you imagine if Paul capitulated to the culture like that? He neither avoids the marketplace of ideas, nor does he accommodate to it. Rather, he takes the unchanging truth about God into a forever changing marketplace of ideas. And he says, do you want to know the real one? The one behind all of your other ones? Do you want to know God? And so there's two questions here. And I'd love you to just turn to your neighbor and discuss this. Think back through your own life and your own walk with God, and even just the way you do evangelism. Do you have a public view of faith or a private view of faith? Do you think there's something about God which is inherently public or needs to be kept private? What about your own journey has made you think that? And what about you thinking that should you be free from, having heard about what Paul himself did? So just take 1 minute, and then we'll come back together for the second point. Okay. We'll just bring those to a close. I've just glimpsed the time, and this is the tyranny of every sermon I give. So we'll come back in. What I'm going to do is we'll address the second point, what Paul saw, and then I'm going to draw out some implications, which would have been from the fourth point, but I'll bring us to a shorter close so we can draw out some real practical stuff that I've found really helpful. So we're going to talk about what Paul saw. So you jump down again to verse, I think it's 16. Yeah, wonderful. And it says, while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. And now I'm not sure what you think about when you come to do evangelism, whether you think about the content you want to get across or the things that other people believe. But just take note of what Paul does when he comes to Athens and wants to engage evangelistically. It says the text that he saw the idols. And it uses an interesting term, which is actually unique in the whole of the scriptures. It's this Greek term, which means to see under, anathereo. Anathereo, my goodness, that's just not the language I speak, isn't it? But the imagery is this, that there's a city, and the city is under idols. And that, I mean, that just would have been true. If Paul came to Athens, he would have come on the, I think it's the west side that most scholars think. And if he's coming from the west side, then while he's still a long way off, he would have seen all the Parthenon, the temples, all the gods, all the statues, Zeus, Athena, all of that stuff. He would have seen it as he's coming. And Luke's trying to get across something here, that when Paul comes to a place, he's not just looking at what people think, he's looking at what people love. He's looking at their worship. I don't know what comes to mind when you think about doing evangelism, but that's a great question to ask. What do people love? One Roman satirist joked about Athens, and he said that it was easier there to find an idol than it was a man. Athens was under idols. And so our contemporary moment would see all the things in Athens, the statues, the idols, they'd see them as like cultural artifacts. And therefore, because they're cultural artifacts, our contemporary moment and culture would be one which says something like, ah, we don't have idols. We don't worship stuff. We're secular. But it actually doesn't mean that we're any less worshippers. It just means our idols have changed. There's a wonderful postmodern novelist. Some of you would have heard about this guy, David Foster Wallace. And he himself was an atheist, but he said it like this. There's something else that's weird but true. In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is actually no such thing as atheism. There is no such thing as not worshipping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. Now, why did he say that? Because worship is the habit of entrusting your meaning, significance, safety, and success to something, which if you don't have it, will make you feel meaningless, vulnerable, worthless, despairing, and fearful. Now, contemporary culture might be superficially different from ancient ones, but they're fundamentally the same. We all have worships. See, the real problem with the world is not the bad things, but the good things that we make God things. It's not the philosophies of the world, but the allegiances of our heart that get to the heart of who we are. And it's the Christian story that helps us see under everything that the human heart is really good at worshiping things that aren't God. It might be pleasure, success, whatever it is. So here's the clue. Here's the clue that I've just found so helpful in my evangelism. When you're doing evangelism and you're speaking with someone, don't just look for their philosophies. Look for their philos. Don't just look for what they think about. Look for what they love. To what is their heart given in allegiance? Who is their Lord? For a lot of us in Western secular culture, it's going to be ourselves, and our God's going to be happiness. For those in Canary Wharf in London, it's going to be business and success and fame and wealth. For those going to school, it's just surviving the social experiment that high school is. But there's always going to be something that people love. We need to ask people questions on this level. And this brings me to something I found really practical, and it's called worldview talk. Has anyone ever heard of the concept of worldview before? Just raise your hand. Wonderful. So it shouldn't be too foreign. But worldview, I've found, actually has two sort of aspects to it. You might be familiar with one, but I want to get at the other one as well. Those aspects are the intellectual and the affective, or the intellectual and the loves. It's not just about what we think, but what we give our allegiance to. And so we'll hit the intellectual side first, and then I'll open up for discussion. Then we'll hit the affective side second, and we'll open up for discussion. Then we'll probably be at 3 p.m. by that point. So On the intellectual side, James Altheus, he's a Christian philosopher, he says this about a worldview. A worldview is a framework or set of fundamental beliefs through which we view the world and our calling and future in it. Now, it's a bit wordy, but his point is, any worldview is a view of the world which answers a host of fundamental questions. And he articulates seven questions. I'll give them to you, but then I'll give you four easier ones, so write the second lot down. So he thinks the fundamental questions which any worldview, any take on life gives are these. What is prime reality? God? God's plural? Or something external? Or something material? What is the nature of external reality? Is external reality ordered or is it chaotic? Is it intentional or accidental? What is a human being? Are they a machine? Are they a soul? What are they? What happens to a person at death? Are they extinct? Do they live on? Is it torturous? Is it good? Why is it possible to know anything at all? The evolution of the human brain, the intention of a mind behind our minds, and he goes on. There's two other questions, but I'll get to the four more helpful ones, and they're articulated actually by the guy who began the ministry that I work for, Ravi Zacharias. And those questions are the question of origin, the question of meaning, the question of morality, and the question of destiny. Where do I come from? Why am I here? How do I live my life? And where am I going? Now, if you were to ask anyone what they would say to those four questions, the answer they give will reveal the worldview they have. So what I want to do now is I just want to take the three main worldviews and just open it up for discussion and get us thinking about this. The three main worldviews at base really are atheism, theism, and monism, or pantheism. Those two words are interchangeable. Atheism says there's no God, the material world is all there is. Theism, that's us, hooray, says there is a God, but he's separate from the material world. So there's two realities, not just one, the material and the supermaterial God. And then monism, or pantheism, says that God is this world. So there's one reality. We see it as physical, but it's actually God. And you'll notice, even just as you think about conversations you've had in the past, where people that you've talked to would fit on that spectrum. If someone says something like, don't you just feel God? They could be a theist who think God's separate but is interacting with this world, or they could be a monist who thinks that they themselves are God by some weird miracle chance. And so there's these four questions, and I just want us to turn to one another and think about how these questions would be answered by these different worldviews. And the reason this practice is so helpful is because if you have someone in the back of your mind who you've never gotten to know their worldview, this will give you the language and the metrics with which to figure out what worldview they have. And if you know what worldview they have, you can better address them as a questioner, not just as a question. So, let's do theism, and we'll do this one. I'll do this one with you here now. I'll get you to raise your hand and answer to the questions, and then we'll do the other two worldviews just in groups for 5 minutes. So, theism. What does theism say about where we come from? Just raise a hand. I was going to say there's no wrong answer. There is. But I trust all being Christians in the room that you will know the answer to this question. And use whatever language you like, but the idea will get across. So where does theism say that the world, us, creation, comes from? Yes, Moria, sorry. God, spot on. God. We come from God. Now, you'll notice, the moment you answer that question, the questions of meaning and morality all of a sudden become easier to answer, do they not? If God's out of the picture, what do we say about morality and meaning? Well, there's nothing ultimate per se, okay. But if God's in the question, if God's actually made us, well, actually we can say a lot more about meaning and morality. So let's go there. What does theism say about meaning? Why are we here? Anyone? Yes. Because God loves us, yes, absolutely. Yeah, Genesis 1, Genesis 2. He made us for himself. That's Augustine. Our hearts are restless. We're not here by chance. We were made for him. Absolutely, God made us. And then the third question, how do we live our lives? What does theism say about morality? This one actually does get a bit more complex because it's the question of ethics, isn't it? Great. Yeah, great, absolutely, yeah. And theologians will flesh that out, you know, with different theories of ethics, but that's actually at the heart of the question, being obedient to God. And what does that look like? Wonderful. And then the last thing is, what does theism say about destiny? Where are we going? To be with God, yes, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. To be with God, heaven, eternal life. Jesus, John 17:3, this is eternal life, that you may know him. We're going to be with him. That's Revelation 21. He'll be at the center of our worship. All right, so just in groups now, I want you to talk with just the person next to you and just consider the question, what does atheism say about origin, meaning, morality, and destiny? And we'll just do that one worldview. We'll just take 2 minutes for that now. So we could do the monism or the pantheism worldview, but we'll save that for another time. We'll move straight on through. There's two things that I want to draw out as implications for this concept of worldview. And the first one is that it's not just about the intellect, it's about what we love. And in that sense, I just want to read you the rest of the quote that I got from James Altheus. He says this, "A worldview need not be fully articulated. It may be so internalized that it goes largely unquestioned by the person. It may not be explicitly developed into a systematic doctrine. It may not be theoretically deepened into a philosophy. It may not even be codified into creedal form." And what he's getting at there, actually, is that a worldview is not something which, if you talk to someone, they're going to have fully articulated even in their own minds. They might have just grown up in the soil of secularism, but they might be an atheist, but they might answer the meaning question with, "No, we've got meaning. We've got ultimate meaning." That would be inconsistent with the answer that they give to the first question, "What's humanity?" But for them, it's not, because they haven't fully articulated it. And this actually gets across the part of having a worldview, which I think is less about the intellect and more about the soil in which we've grown up, more about the allegiances that we give our heart over to. And this has an implication. It's this. People don't realize that the worldview they have, or they have a very incoherent one. And this is so crucial to keep in mind as you do evangelism. If people don't realize they have a worldview, either because they don't think about it systematically, or they just are so distracted with their lives, then it means that you could very much be an agent of revelation in their lives. You can ask those questions. What do you think about where we come from? What do you think about where we're going? And the moment they start answering those questions in an inconsistent way, for example, "Oh, we come from nothing. Where are we going?" Paradise. That's no like opportunity to club them over the head with their inconsistency. It's an opportunity to gently lean in and say, "Can I tell you about paradise? Can I tell you about where we've come from?" Most people don't realize they have a worldview. And if you know that everyone does, which they do, you can be an agent of revelation in their lives. There's the same gentleman I mentioned before, David Foster Wallace, he tells this parable of two fish. I wonder if you've heard this one before. The two fish are some young fish, and they're swimming along. And they're having a great time chatting with one another. And then all of a sudden, this older fish swims past them. And the older fish says to the two younger fish, "Hey boys, how's the water?" And they don't reply. They swim on, and they're both really confused. And the reason they're confused is articulated in a question that one of them asks to the other. And the question is this: what the heck is water? And the thing that the question gets across is this, that actually some of the most present realities in our lives, the most ubiquitous things, are the ones that we are least aware of. And when you think about people in this world who have grown up in a certain culture with a certain view of things, actually a lot of people won't know their worldview. It's going to be the least apparent thing to them. And so if you can be someone who says, "Hey, do you know you're in water? Hey, have you ever thought about your worldview?" You're going to give them a matrix of questions to ask about what they think about this world and themselves in it. And that unlocks a whole host of deeper conversation. The second thing it means is that people with different worldviews experience evidence and argument differently, therefore. And this is so huge. The point's illustrated really well by a story told. I got this story from a gentleman named John Dixon. He's an Anglican minister in Sydney, and he writes a book called Jesus, A Short Life, a wonderful introduction to the historical reliability of the Gospels and the resurrection of Jesus. But he tells this story. A man woke up one morning convinced he was dead. His wife thought he was joking and cheekily asked him how he could be talking about being dead. But it soon became clear that he was serious. He was officially dead. And so after various attempts of trying to convince him otherwise, she finally invited a brilliant psychiatrist to interview him and try and remedy the situation. No change. So eventually the psychiatrist had an idea. He opened one of his weighty medical textbooks and showed this man who thought he was dead that dead people don't bleed. With the heart stopping and the blood coagulating, a puncture to the skin just won't allow blood to come out. He said slowly and precisely, a dead body cannot bleed. The evidence was really compelling, and so the man said, I think you're right. And so the psychiatrist gave him one offer, and that offer was this: why don't we poke you with a pin? And if you bleed, you'll know you're not dead. And so he says, yeah, go for it. And so with one foul swoop, the man reached for a pin, punctured the man. The psychiatrist reached for a pin, punctured the man, and then a tiny fountain of blood starts pouring from his arm. And then astonished, the man looked at the psychiatrist and he said this: well, what do you know? Dead people do bleed after all. And I think what this actually reveals to us is that if people have worldviews they're not aware of, it means they're going to interact with evidence differently, which means what can convince you might not convince them. And that's huge when you're talking about giving a defense for the Christian faith and doing evangelism. If someone disagrees with the evidence you bring them, it doesn't mean the evidence isn't good enough. It means the path you've taken to get there might not be relevant enough. Worldviews are like lenses which bring into focus some things and take out of focus other things. And so if someone's got a scientific background, then arguments about the limits of science are going to be really helpful for them. And talking about those experiences of transcendence that they have, that sense within them that this world is not all there is, talking about that, it's going to be really helpful. If someone's got a background in history, then talking about the reliability of the Gospels will be really helpful. And talking about the historical case for the resurrection will be really helpful. I was chatting with a guy at Sussex last week, and I won't share his name, but he's not a Christian, but he's very spiritual and very open. And those kind of people are incredible to talk with because they're so challenging, for one. But the other thing that's cool about them is they're just really open to be prayed for and stuff like that. But they're really close to the idea that I'd have like a systematized faith to share with them that they need to sign off on theologically. And so we were chatting and he basically shared with me this statement. He said, Jesus is an awesome guy. I just don't know if I agree with all the beliefs. And I was like, oh, what do you think? So I asked him this question. I said, what do you think Christianity is? And he says, oh, it's this. Essentially, he didn't say these words, but he essentially said it's this belief system. Now, I don't know how you reflect on your own journey with God, but one of the things I consistently do every 3 years is I look back and think, wow, I believed that? Was I really a Christian? Oh my goodness, thank God my mind's matured and my belief systems have become more accurate. I think that experience alone lets us know that being a Christian isn't just about signing off on a particular systematized creed. That's definitely part of it. But I think there's more to being Christian. That's why Jesus didn't just say he was the truth. That's why he said he was the way. There's someone to follow. There's a friend with whom we can be proximate. And so one thing I gave him was the analogy of what it means for me to come to know and love and commit to my wife. There's a lot of things about my wife which I know. But knowing about her is very different to having a relationship with her. They're not exclusive. In fact, the more I'm in relationship with her, the more I'll know about her. That's really key. But when I think about marrying my wife, I don't think, what do I know about her? I think, who is she? Am I close with her? Will I commit to her? And if it's true that being a Christian isn't just about signing off on a particular set of beliefs, but actually coming into relationship with Jesus Christ, then it informed what I got to say to this guy. I said, do you know actually being a Christian means being a friend of Jesus? That was groundbreaking for him. Because all of a sudden, there wasn't this creed that he needed to sign off on. There was. That would happen, absolutely. But I think we all know that our beliefs mature over time. And so if he could get in his head that Jesus was a friend, that by his Spirit he could interact with him, know him, and that the knowledge about God would come and get more refined, and what would seem exclusive before outside of relationship with God now seems normal because I'm so close with him. That for him was groundbreaking. And we got to pray together. I don't know where he is now, but I think when you realize people have worldviews for whom different evidence and different arguments mean different things, if you can be faithful to the unchanging message of the gospel, that God's done everything necessary for us to be in relationship with him, then you can use any avenue you want. Now, that's not a capitulation to the culture. That's not accommodating the marketplace, not at all. Because Jesus is still Lord, and he's still going to change your life, and you get to talk about those things. But I think it just acknowledges the humanness with which we all do this journey of discipleship with God. Yes, there's a belief system, and let's mature in that together, but in the context of relationship. And for this guy, for whom a barrier of beliefs to sign off on was so difficult, knowing that Jesus wanted to be his friend was huge. And now we get to talk about beliefs with him, and that's a game changer. The last thing I want to do is look at what Paul said, and then we'll break for lunch. You'll notice, actually, that if you go down to verse 22, it says this, Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "People of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' So you are ignorant of the very thing you worship. And this is what I proclaim to you." Now, I've only got a few minutes, so I'll try and do this quickly, and then whatever we want to chat about later, we can. There's an old story that sort of provides the context for this encounter, and it goes a little like this. There's supposedly a plague in Athens in the 6th century BC. During a plague, offerings to propitiate all the plagues to all known deities were proved ineffective. And so there was a bunch of idols and temples and that kind of stuff in Athens, all representing different gods that would do stuff if you placated them. And so people would bring their offerings to these gods thinking that that would stop the plague. And nothing worked. And so when the Cretan Epimenides was called to stay the plague, he ordered that black and white sheep wander the Areopagus, and where each lay down, sacrifice was offered to the deity associated with that site. Athens had consented to sacrifice the humans to propitiate gods. In historical times, they would appeal to gods in the times of plague. And then what happened was, when none of the things that were working worked, when nothing worked, they just created an altar to an unknown god. Because none of the gods that they had worked, and so they created an altar to an unknown god, thinking that if they just sacrificed to this thing, which they don't have the information for, they could stop the plague. It's kind of like god insurance, and that's actually the history of this altar, at least as the legend goes. And here's where it gets really interesting. When Paul comes to the Areopagus, different from the things that he'd do when he's in the synagogue, he doesn't take out the scriptures and preach from there about Jesus being the Messiah that they longed for. Although that's true, he goes to the altar, the pagan altar, to an unknown god, and he kind of uses that as his scripture in a way. Not his authority, but he uses that as the launching pad with which to engage people that he clearly disagrees with philosophically. And that's huge. Because it means what Paul's doing is he's actually speaking the language that they speak. Now, here's a question that comes up whenever you look at this instance, and it's this. Did Paul's acknowledgement about something unknown serve to confirm the beliefs they had about God or deny them? And the reason that question's really interesting is actually because there was a book written. I can't remember what it's called. I think it's called the Jesus Christ in Hinduism. But the argument that the book makes is that if Paul can go to an unknown altar in a pagan society and preach from it, can we go to other parts of other people's belief systems and confirm them as well? In some sense, making the claim that people don't need to become Christians to follow Jesus, they just need to be sincere believers in their own worldview. And that's a scary thing to consider. The claims of Jesus Christ are exclusive. And so Paul's not saying your worship is good in of itself. What he's saying is your worship is normal, but the content of your worship is flawed. Paul's not pointing out their worship as good because it's sincere. He's pointing out their worship is normal, but the object of their worship needs to change. And so he says, the altar to the unknown God, I see it, but that which you don't know, I now proclaim to you. And here's my last little takeaway point, and I'll draw a few little implications here. My last little takeaway point, whenever we do evangelism with people, is often we want to think about what divides us and creates barriers and what seems exclusive and necessary for someone to come to faith. What the Apostle Paul does is he takes the very thing that they thought was saving them and says, I see that, and it's normal. Here's why you're ignorant. In other words, he makes a contact with them. He finds something in the culture that connects, something they already are centered around, something in which their hopes already are. And then he shows them how that itself won't satisfy and how Jesus Christ is a way better God, not least of which because he's true. He finds a contact point. My little threefold mnemonic for this is, whenever we engage with culture and then in evangelism, there's things about culture which we can receive, things about culture which we need to reject, and there's things about culture which we need to redeem. That's good cultural engagement, but it's also really good evangelism. Here's what that means. For my friend, for whom belief and a system of beliefs was so foreign to him, I got to say, I know that you love experiencing spiritual realities. That's going to crush you. Not just because it's not true, but if you really are engaged in spiritual practices outside the goodness of a God we can trust who's revealed himself in Jesus, it's going to ruin you. You'll be forever at the mercy of placating those gods. And that's actually why paganism failed and why Christianity was so popular, because God of the Bible is so faithful. So Paul finds a contact point, so too should we. And then we should show how those things in which people put their trust don't actually ultimately satisfy nor are true. And then we redeem it. And what does Paul do? Paul makes 5 points about God, and I won't go into them. The first point is God is transcendent. The second point is that God is a father of all creation. The third point is that he can't be served by humans in temples. And the fifth point is the resurrection. He can actually be trusted because he's revealed himself in history. Check it out. He goes through these 5 points, and each time he makes these points, just go through it in your own time. You'll notice he does something absolutely fascinating. Each time he goes through, he shows where the gospel connects with culture and the things in which they put their hope, where it departs and how they're wrong, and then ultimately how Jesus Christ is the God who ultimately satisfies. And that's an incredible model for evangelism, because it means that whenever we go to someone, the first port of call we should always have in our mind is, what do they love? What do they already love? And how's it crushing them? Some people love success. And if you love success so much, it means that you'll be forever anxious to get it. And when you get it, you'll feel incredibly lonely. There's a story told of the richest man in the world in the 20th century, John D. Rockefeller, who's asked this question. How much money is enough? And he responded with these famous words, just a little bit more. What do people love? How can you take what they love and show them how it's crushing them and then give them the balm of the gospel with the beauty of Jesus? Cool. We could talk about that for ages. I'm going to finish it there. I didn't get round to my last point, which is what Paul felt. And we can address that in the Q&A if you'd like to. But I think it's lunchtime. So let me pray for us, and then we'll keep this discussion going over lunch. Father, oh, Lord, thank you that you alone are the one who, if we fail, will forgive us, and if we find you, will save us and satisfy us. No other God will do that. Nothing in which we put our hope will do that. And so, God, when we think about addressing people with the questions and objections they have and how best the gospel fits, we just pray, Father, keep us faithful to the truth of your word, but keep us flexible with how we talk to people and the needs that they have, and ultimately point them to Jesus, who loves them. Father, be with us as we enjoy this food. Would you bless it to our bodies? Keep us healthy. And Lord, I just pray that you would be in our midst. In Jesus' name.